are listening to Stories from Palestine podcast, a bi-weekly podcast recorded in Palestine and about Palestine. My name is Crystal. I studied history and tour guiding, and I live in Palestine with my Palestinian husband and children. I'm originally from the Netherlands. I am a licensed tour guide by the Palestinian Authority, and yes, you can hire me for tours. Follow me on social media and visit my website to learn more about organized tours and programs. You can find the links in the show notes. I hope you will enjoy listening to this episode. It's been a while since I recorded the last episode, and that is mainly because I am really very busy with the tour guide program that I am doing in Jerusalem. And it is Ramadan now, and I wish everybody Ramadan Kareem, especially those who are fasting during this holy month of Ramadan. And that also changes a lot of the program and schedule, especially that the Palestinian Authority decided not to change to summertime until after the month of Ramadan, which means that we who live in Beit Tzafafa in Jerusalem, we are already on summertime, but in the West Bank, they are still on wintertime. So now we have an hour of difference between us. And as our children go to school in the West Bank and we have our bar and cafe in the West Bank, we are traveling frequently between two different time zones, which is very difficult when you are calculating at what time you have to meet somebody in the West Bank and then what time you have to be back to meet somebody else in Jerusalem. And the school also starts an hour later during Ramadan. So I have been very confused over the past few days, and I hope that I will get used to it. In the meantime, I started to feel bad about not uploading a new podcast episode. And I have also had a lot of questions from people about how I am experiencing this new tour guide program on the Jerusalem side, which is run by the Israeli Ministry of Tourism. And as you all know, I have gone through the Bethlehem Bible College before, through the whole 2 years program to become a tour guide licensed by the Palestinian Ministry of Tourism. And good news, I finally got the license in my hands. If you follow me on social media, then you will have seen the pictures of me finally tour guiding in the Church of Nativity with the license. And that is an amazing feeling. It's a great accomplishment, I think, not only the studying I did for almost 3 years, because after we finished studying the 2 years program, we had a whole year until we had the exam by the ministry, and I kept studying and repeating and visiting places. So that was quite an effort. But it's also just really great to be able to guide and to take people around, to show them the history and the heritage of this beautiful land. And of course, I also talk about the reality of life, the geopolitical situation. So I have had a chance to take quite a few people around. And all of this made that I did not have time to record any new episodes. Not that I run out of topics. There are so many things that we can still talk about and discuss, but it's just the time that I do not have at the moment. But because many people have asked me about my experience, I said I will record a special episode to tell you a little bit more about that. So let me start by describing the tour guide course that I'm doing now and why I am doing that. It is because there is an agreement between the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli authorities about how many Palestinians or people with a tour guide license that was given by the Palestinian Ministry of Tourism, how many of those can actually tour guide on the Israeli side. And that number has been reached, the maximum, and there is a long waiting list. So now that I have the license, although I did the general exam, I did the exam that covers all of the country, I'm not able now or allowed to guide in Jerusalem or other places. And also last summer, we still didn't know when the Palestinian Ministry of Tourism would give us the exam. So one afternoon in the summer holidays, I was sitting in my garden and realizing this, and I said, I need to get the Israeli tour guide license. And I talked to some friends who already done the course and who've already done the exam and are working as tour guides. And they all advised me to do it. They all told me it's very comprehensive. It is not easy. You have to study a lot. There's a lot of new things you will learn. There is many trips that you have to do. And of course, it wasn't cheap. And I maybe you remember that at some point I did a fundraiser and it was fantastic because I had over 60 people who supported me and the fundraiser. Within 3 days, I had the amount that I was trying to fundraise. So I also feel that I have a lot of support of people to do this. So funnily enough, the Palestinian Ministry of Tourism, shortly after I registered for the tour guide course in Jerusalem, decided to organize the exam. So in the same weekend, the last weekend of November, that I did the exam, on Saturday we did the written exam, and on Monday we did the oral exam. The Sunday in between, I had my first meeting at the tour guide program in Jerusalem. So one thing ended and a new thing started. And now I've been in this course for about 4 months. And I'll tell you a little bit about it. We are 46 participants. 16 of them are Palestinians from Jerusalem. Some of them are Christians. We have Greek Orthodox, Catholic, Syriac, Armenian, Lutheran. So there is all these different Christian denominations. And we also have Muslim Palestinians. And then there is one American who is here because his wife is working for the American embassy and he's doing the course because he's just very interested in learning more about the history of the country. And he is our photographer in the group. And he also was the one who took the pictures of me on my first day of tour guiding because he brought some of his friends and they did a tour with me. He also ran the marathon in Bethlehem, by the way. He's a very nice guy. And then the other participants are Jewish Israelis, and all of them did not grow up in Israel. They were born in other parts of the world, people from America, from Latin America also, from New Zealand, from Canada, different European countries. And they made what they call Aliyah, and they came to live here in the past years. Their Hebrew is not so strong, and that's why they chose to do the English speaking course. So you can imagine the diversity of the group, and I'll also tell you a little bit about that. On the introduction day, the coordinator made it very clear to us that we are going to learn the Zionist narrative. He acknowledged that there are different narratives, but he said, you chose to do this program through the Ministry of Tourism in Israel, so you're going to learn the Zionist narrative. And so that was very clear from the beginning. The program consists of 60 trips that we have to do, 60 excursions all around the country. Every Tuesday we have lectures at the university, and there are quite a big number of videos that we have to watch also. So that is how we get our information. And of course, you are free to read more and visit more sites as much as you like and as much time as you have. In this program, we are not visiting some of the sites that I studied during the program in the West Bank. So we are not going to go to Nablus or Jericho, Ramallah, Hebron, yes. Bethlehem, no. Hebron, they will go. But in Hebron, they are going to go to the Ibrahimi Mosque, the part that has been made into synagogue, and they will come through the settlements. And that's something that I have difficulties with. So I may not join that excursion, but I have enough knowledge about Hebron because I've visited it multiple times. And I've also studied it in the Bethlehem Bible College. There's also excursions, for example, to Herodion and to Shiloh. But all of these are sites in Area C in the West Bank. So they don't go to Area A, where the Palestinian Authority is in control. So far, all the classes have been taught and all the tour guides that we've had have been Jewish Israelis. I don't know if we are going to have some Palestinians, Jerusalemites, or with Israeli citizenship who are going to tour us around, but until now, that was not the case. Of course, it took some time for all the participants to start to get to know each other, but it was very obvious from the beginning that the Palestinians who know that the narrative we're going to learn will be different from some of the things that they experience in their daily lives would, you know, form a group within the group. And that is definitely something that is happening. And I'm also, I feel more close to the Palestinians because I speak their language. I don't speak Hebrew. And most of Jewish Israelis, even though their Hebrew is not strong, they do speak Hebrew. But also culturally, since I'm married to a Palestinian, since I live between Palestinians, it's much more easy for me to feel free and to feel comfortable in that group. And we've also sometimes been exchanging some information where we felt like we were lacking some information, things that were not taught or not talked about. An example of that is when we drive through the landscape and there is a destroyed, demolished Palestinian village, some of which you can still see. You can still see the ruins of some of the Palestinian villages that were attacked by Zionist militias in 1948, and the population has been forcibly displaced. The only thing the tour guide will say is that this was an Arab town until 1948, without further explanation, without talking about what happened and what made these Palestinians leave, as if it was by choice that they left and they just never came back. So rather than giving any information about it, they preferred not to mention anything at all. And that was something that I found very obvious. Recently, we've been on an excursion to the Golan Heights. And as you may know, that is occupied Syrian Golan Heights, occupied by Israel in 1967 in the Six-Day War. And the tour guide there was talking about how the Syrians who lived there in the village where we were at that moment, how they went back to Syria. And I said to myself, how do you mean went back to Syria? They were living in Syria. They were in their homes, and then they were forced to move, and so they became refugees. They moved to another part of Syria, and they were expelled from their village, from their home. But she made it sound as if these people were just roaming around. Maybe they were some sort of nomads or Bedouins, and, you know, the war happened, and Israel conquered the land, and they went back to Syria. So this is a bit how I see that they build up their narrative when it comes to the occupied territories. During our trips, we do also visit quite a lot of memorials, whether it is, for example, in Beersheba, we went to the Anzac Museum and Cemetery. Anzac stands for the Australian New Zealand Armed Corps, which was a corps of soldiers coming from Australia, New Zealand, which was still part of the Commonwealth of the British Empire. And they joined the British forces when they were fighting against the Ottomans. And there is a whole museum that talks about how they came. They were mainly cavalry. They were mainly on horseback. And how there was a big battle at Beersheba. And how they eventually managed to defeat the Ottomans there. And they have also a war cemetery there, British War Cemetery. There are several of those in the country. We visited some memorial sites in the Golan Heights, also related to what happened in 1967 in the Six Days War. And of course, from the Israeli perspective, they are talking mainly about their losses, commemorating losses of soldiers, but also being proud of their victory. So they have a lot of places. Actually, most of them are sleeping volcanoes. They are in the landscape, kind of smaller hills, volcano hills, on which they had bunkers and outposts and Israeli flags everywhere. So yeah, that is definitely a focus when people are traveling in the occupied Golan Heights. Another focus I see in this course when I compare it to the course in the Bethlehem Bible College is, of course, on Judaism and the history of the Jewish people in the land. In the Bible College, we focused a lot on Christianity and much more on the Christian pilgrim sides. Here, the focus is very much on what they call the First and Second Temple period. So scholars worldwide would call these periods the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. And after that, we have the Persian period, the Hellenistic period, the Roman period, the early Byzantine period. But here they often use First and Second Temple period. And then they refer to the temple that was built by King Solomon, the son of King David. And that temple was destroyed by the Babylonians in the year 586 before Common Era. And some decades later, the temple was rebuilt. Originally, it was a small temple. And then during the Hasmonean period, which is the 100 years where there was a kind of Jewish dynasty, the Hasmonean or Maccabean dynasty, that is when the temple was a bit enlarged. And then Herod the Great, that we all know from the Bible story of the killing of the innocents, the babies, when Jesus was born, the same King Herod the Great, he renovated and renewed the temple to be very big. And that temple was destroyed in the year 70 AD by the Romans. Now, this is a very big focus in this course. Everything related to the 10th century BC until the 70 AD. And interesting is that from the 10th century BC, which is supposedly the time of the big King David and King Solomon, in archaeology, they don't actually find a lot of evidence that shows that in that period, there was a big kingdom. Also, there are almost no inscriptions or mentions of King David and King Solomon in extra-biblical sources, which means in sources that are not the Bible. So, for example, some of the bigger kingdoms, the Egyptian kingdoms, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, do not really write anything about King David and King Solomon, which is interesting if it was such a big kingdom. And so in Israel itself, you have archaeologists that are mainly the ones that are in Tel Aviv University. They are called the minimalists, who say there probably was never a big kingdom of King Solomon or King David. Maybe they were important local tribe leaders. Maybe they had an important role in that time, but not as big and important as nowadays people think about it. They have been attributed much more power and fame in later period of time. It's been sort of written into the history. And then you have what they call the maximalists, who are the scholars usually related to the Jerusalem University, the Hebrew University. And they find every piece of evidence that they find to prove that there was something during that 10th century before Common Era period. They see that as a proof that there was a kingdom of David and of King Solomon. And it seems that this is so relevant because of the link that the Jewish people today have with the land. And it seems to me a bit of a justification for why they are so convinced that they have rights in this land and why they could replace a whole population in order to build up their state. So we have been focusing a lot on that period, even though there are many scholars who do not agree with, for example, in Jerusalem, the city of David, which is, I did a podcast episode on that too, with an archaeologist who's very critical on what's happening there, where they are trying to prove that there was a big palace for King David. But there are many archaeologists who say, well, there is definitely, there was a big building, but we don't have any proof that says that this was actually a palace or that it was from the time of King David or that it belonged to King David. In the meantime, in that area, it's a Palestinian neighborhood called Silwan, which is basically ancient Jerusalem, because the old city of Jerusalem is not ancient Jerusalem. Now, when people go and visit the old city of Jerusalem, they are in a part of Jerusalem that is from a later time, not the oldest part of the city. The oldest part of the city is Silwan, and this is outside of the current city walls. And the Palestinians who live there are slowly seeing, or quite rapidly actually seeing, that in their neighborhood, there are so many excavations going on to find some remains of the time of King David, that this is affecting their homes. There have been people who have been forced to leave their homes. They are digging a lot of tunnels underneath in order to retrace Roman roads that led up to the temple. And this has caused a lot of houses up on the surface to become almost uninhabitable, with cracks and with lots of problems in the walls, in the ceilings, all just to show and to prove that there was a palace of King David and other buildings related to that time period. So for us, honestly, it is not always easy to listen to those stories and to keep quiet. And I am trying really to take in the information and, you know, to be as objective as possible and to really understand also their narrative. But there are moments where I find it hard when I see something that is really not just. So, for example, we were at the Siloam Pool down in Silwan, and the tour guide is explaining that they are trying to excavate the other part of these ancient pools. And I see that there is an area where Palestinians used to have a kind of a green area, which is now being excavated. So I just made a remark and said, well, excavating these pools definitely has an effect on the people who are living here today, because one of the few green zones cannot be used anymore. And the tour guide said something that, like, yeah, that they were not using it anyway, and anyway, it was private property. And I couldn't get my head around that sentence, because what does that mean? If it's private property, it's okay to confiscate it and to start digging there to find remains of an old ancient pool. The people who are living there today are now suffering from less and less and less space, especially for the children in Silwan. There is no more places where they can play. And only so that they can make this tourist attraction, because that's what it is going to be, bigger, and they will bring more and more tourists and take over the whole neighborhood of Silwan. So, yeah, I don't know. It's hard sometimes to deal with that. It happened also when we were on our way to Herodion. Herodion is also in the West Bank. It's in Area C. And we were going to pick up our tour guide on the way. And as we were going, I realized we were going to pick him up in Efrat. Now, Efrat is a settlement in the heart of the West Bank. It's called Efrat after the biblical name for Bethlehem. And this name was given to a city that has been built over the last decades to give it a biblical touch, to give the impression that it has been there, you know, forever, that the people have roots there. But it's an old name that is being given to a new settlement. And the settlement is built on the land of Palestinian farmers from Al-Ghadr, the village close to Bethlehem, who have not been compensated for the confiscation of their land. And as we were going there, one of the students turns out to live in that settlement. And she's all excited and she takes the microphone and she wants to talk about Efrat. And she starts saying that, yes, we're going to Efrat. That is the city where I live. And I couldn't not say anything. So I mentioned to everybody, I said, Efrat is not a city. Efrat is a settlement. It's built on stolen land from Palestinian farmers. And according to international law, the Geneva Convention, it is not allowed to move, to transfer population of the occupying power into the land that they occupy. So basically, this is illegal. And she was flabbergasted, it seemed. She did not know or realize, as she stated, that it was a settlement. And then we went into the settlement. And I mean, it's quite obvious. You go into the settlement, you have to pass through security. They have gates and so on. And we are in the settlement, picking up the guide. And he takes us to a lookout. And we look out from the top of the settlement down into the Solomon's Pools. Now, the Solomon's Pools are a place where I've been tour guiding quite a number of times when I am in Bethlehem and I take tourists to see these fantastic, amazing pools. Three massive pools that have been made already, the first one in the Hellenistic period, about 100 years before Common Era, and then also in the time of Herod the Great and in the time of Pontius Pilate, the one who convicted Jesus to crucifixion. In that era, these pools were dug and very important aqueduct system was made to retrieve water from a number of springs in the area into the pools. And then from these pools, it was brought through channels, through two different aqueducts to Jerusalem. So it's very interesting. And I've been talking about it a lot. And me, when I talk about it, I'm down in Bethlehem looking at the pools and I'm pointing up to the settlement and telling people, look how close Efrat settlement has grown towards Bethlehem. It's gobbled up most of the agricultural land of the people of Al-Ghadar. And the settlers are right on top of Solomon's pools now. And sometimes they come down, usually with army protection, and they come to walk around the pools. Now I am with Israeli tour guide settler who is looking down at the pools and explaining about the Solomon's pools and then mentions that it's in under Palestinian Authority control. So if we want to visit the pools, which we do sometimes with our youth movement, then we need to have army protection. And this is where my head goes like, oh my God, this is the same place. And we have two different sort of stories about this area and how it is perceived. And yeah, that happens quite a number of times. But let me also tell you something about the group and the diversity in our group. It's been actually really interesting. We've had a meeting about 2.5 months into the program when we were on a 3-day trip to Eilat, where the second day we did kind of an evaluation and everybody was to say something about themselves and how they've been enjoying the program, what they've been learning, what they've been enjoying the most. And the vast majority of the students, especially the Jewish Israeli ones, mentioned the diversity in the group and how much they are learning about others. And from the talks we had that day and in other conversations, I realized that many of these people grew up in a kind of bubble, thinking that only Jewish people have a connection to the land and the history of the land. And I can see now also with the focus on history of the Jewish people in the land and not having that much attention to a lot of other centuries in which a lot of other people were living in the land. And even during the periods where Jewish people were living there, there were pagans, there were Greeks, there were Romans, there were different tribes. It was a very multicultural land. It's always been. It's a land bridge between different continents. People come and go. Different empires have ruled the area. Sometimes they brought in soldiers, sometimes citizens, mostly they brought in rulers. And the people who lived there, they just lived there and they mingled and there were intermarriages. And that's why the population is so diverse also. The Palestinians are very diverse in how they look, in their hair color, their skin color, their eye color. So now these Jewish Israelis they were immigrants, they come here. And now for the first time, they are starting to talk with native people, people who've been born here, whose parents and grandparents and great, great, great parents are from here and who are Christian, Muslim, different denominations. And they're starting to listen to their stories and how they relate and connect to this land. And it's an eye-opener for them. They have been asking a lot of questions and they've been really introduced to something new. And I do realize that because of propaganda and also because there is censorship in the news, it's, of course, the choice of also media outlets that you read and things that you watch, that they don't have the same knowledge that we have. They don't see the same things that we do. And what they see is interpreted and explained in a different way, is justified with different reasoning. And of course, security is always a big issue. And if you do not know the history really well, then maybe you can misunderstand a lot of things. And that is what I see. I have to say again that most of the students are not from here. They were not born here. They were not raised here. They didn't go through the Israeli school system. They didn't go to the army, most of them, although a few of them did, but most of them didn't. So they do have different perspectives, I think, for that reason. And I also feel that they grew up with more diversity in the countries where they came from, maybe a bit more of critical thinking in their curriculum, in their education, more than here, probably. So that's interesting. And then there's one more thing I would like to share before I finish, which is an incident that happened last week. And that was one of the things that really startled me. When we go to the university, we go through detection gate, like the ones you have in the airport. And you have to give your bag to the security who will look in your bag, and you have to even give your phone and your keys and everything. You go through that detection gate and then you enter. So what is it that they should detect? You know, is it drugs? I don't know. You would imagine and assume that it's about weapons. So I get to the classroom and I realize that there are two students, Jewish Israeli students, who are carrying handguns very visibly. And I wonder, how is it possible that they came through the security gate, both of them? So I start talking to some of the students and I'm like, why do we have security if there are people who can come in wearing guns? And then we realize that it is because they are Jewish Israelis that they are allowed to carry guns. But if any of the 16 Palestinians in our group would have even tried to enter with a weapon through the security, they'd probably be arrested, shot, I don't know. It would have been ugly. So it made me realize that in this country, we have this double standard where some citizens can wear weapons and other citizens and residents cannot. And this makes you realize that there is no equality between people. There are people that are more equal for the law than others. And this is, I think, one of the hardest things, seeing this happening, where you are studying together, learning information, going on excursions, you know, even enjoying, you know, you are enjoying the nature, the places where you are, but then realizing that there is some of the people in the group who have the right self-determination, who have the right to carry weapons, who have the right to take any job that they want. And in the same time, in the same group, we have people who do not have the same rights and privileges. And that is sometimes very confronting. But I have to say, it's the first time for me to have this experience, to be with these different people in one group. And I'm observing, I am learning, I'm experiencing, I'm taking a lot of stories from there, comparing the different narratives, what I learned at the Bible College, what I'm learning now. And I think that it gives me a much broader view, much more wide perspective on this land that is so beloved by so many people. Because that's something we all have to admit. Everybody in the group, no matter their background, they all love this land. And that's the end of this week's episode. Thank you for listening. You know, producing this podcast takes a lot of time, and there are also costs for hosting the podcast, for the website, and some of the subscriptions related to online recording and editing. So if you enjoy listening to Stories from Palestine, which is available completely for free, then you can do a donation on the Ko-fi platform, and that is really very helpful, even if it's just a little contribution. Because if all listeners do that once in a while, then I can continue producing new episodes. It's very easy. Just click the link in the show notes right after this message. And I hope you will listen again to the next episodes.